So starting at verse 1 of chapter 1, we read the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanity. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation
comes. Earth remains. And
around and around goes the wind, and so and on its circuit the wind returns.
All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has there is. Yet to be among those who come after. Okay, I'm moving down to verse 13. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out wisdom. All that is done out by wisdom, all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Verse 16, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to new wisdom and to new madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases in knowledge increases in sorrow. Sorry, she said that was verse 16 we were reading there. Then to chapter 2 and verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Down to verse 10. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from new pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Down to verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who comes after me. Then verse 22. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This is also vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. So what we're presented with in these two chapters is really two ways to approach life. Living for gain on the one hand and living the gifts on the other hand. These really are two themes that run right the way through the book that we'll come back to again and again throughout our series. But tonight we look at it with respect to two things. Did you pick up on them when we read? Wisdom and pleasure. But before we get into all of that, there is an introduction here in the first 11 verses. We're introduced to the general idea of living for gain. Now, last Saturday, Claire and I had a meeting at the bank, not something that I've done very often in my life, but the savings account that we have is so old that it no longer exists. You can't take one of these types of savings accounts out, and they're actually bringing them to an end. So we went along to ask the guy What was the best account for us? Which account is going to be most rewarding for us, only to be reminded just how bad interest rates are at the moment? Now, you may have noticed on the screen, or firstly, I'll just flick back to it, our title tonight is Living Under the Sun. Now, this phrase, under the sun, comes up quite a few times in the book. And we're introduced to it in verse 3. Look at verse 3 with me. What does man gain by all his toil at which he toils under the sun? Now, this question actually frames the entire content of the book. Under the sun simply means what happens on earth. And so toiling, then, is it's more than working. It's what happens on earth. Anything that we turn our hand to, that's what toil means. So what's the preacher concerned with? Well, he's concerned with what we do on this earth. But what about this word gain? What does it mean? Well, actually, the Hebrew word literally means what is left behind. So it's kind of what's left over. So it's what we get out of what we put in, if you like. There must be something in this for me. That's the kind of idea of this word gain. It's a bit like that savings account. You know, we take a savings account out because, well, we want to get something out of what we put in, don't we? Otherwise, we just keep the money under our bed. So the question then for this book is all of these things that we do on this earth, what's in it for me? Now, as we discussed last time, the key word in this book is the Hebrew word hevel, which is badly translated in our Bibles as either meaningless or vanity. Neither of these quite hit the mark, and actually they kind of lead to a bit of confusion about what the book is actually saying. Literally, the word hevel means breath. Now, last time, if you were here, I shared what I think is quite a helpful analogy for understanding what it really means in this book. It's this analogy of an Old Testament professor. I think he's now retired, but he used to teach a first-year class in a seminary in America on Ecclesiastes. And what he used to do in the first lesson is they'd come in, they'd sit down, and he'd pull out a big cigar out of his pocket. He'd cut the end off and put it in his mouth, light it. He'd take an enormous draw of this cigar and then blow out this big puff of smoke, and then he proceeded to kind of try and grab the smoke, and as it was diffusing into the air, he'd say to the class, "That is hevel. That's what hevel means. It can't be manipulated or controlled. It can't be used to my own end. It won't last, nor can it be prolonged any longer than it's there for." The preacher opens the whole book with this statement about the world, and it gives us a good indication, really, of why he asked this question. He says in verse 2, "Hevel, hevel," says the preacher, "hevel of hevel, everything is hevel." He looks around at the world and he says, well, it's all like a breath. All that we can do, it's all like a breath. It's uncontrollable, it's uncatchable, it's temporary. So his thesis statement is something like this: a life of gain will never satisfy because everything is hevel. Everything's like a breath. And in verses 4 to 11, the preacher poetically compares humanity to the world which we live in. He says, first, verse 4, a generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. So humans are born, they live, and they die. But comparatively speaking, this world Well, it seems to last forever. It outlasts the generations, doesn't it? It stays the same. And he points to the three ways it stays the same. The sun rises and sets, rises and sets, rises and sets, day by day, year by year, decade by decade. It continues to do that. Then we have the wind. Now, winds blow. They change direction. They go all around the world, if you like, but they always seem to come back and blow in that same direction again. And then rivers, well, you go to a river and it's constantly flowing, isn't it? But are the seas filled up? They're not filled up, but the water keeps pouring into it. These things have always happened. They always will continue to happen. The preacher says they don't change. And all of this leads him to say, all things, this is verse 8, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing it, nor the ear filled with hearing it. What has been is what will be, and what has been is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Well, what does he mean here? Well, allow me an analogy, if you will. Has anyone seen The Lion King? Seen The Lion King? Yeah? You know the start of The Lion King? When all the animals it's a wonderful scene. All the animals are pushing forward, getting towards the rock, and Simba is lifted up and presented to all of these animals, and they all bow down before their new prince. But you know that the music behind that, when all of that's happening, is The Circle of Life. Do you know The Circle of Life? And these are the lyrics for The Circle of Life. From the day we arrived in this planet, blinking, step into the sun, there's more to be seen than can ever be seen, and more to do than can ever be done. It's The Circle of Life. This is the sort of thing that the preacher is on about here. There's too much for us to see. There's too much for us to hear. There's too much for us to do. All these things that are the same. Well, it's tiring just to think about all of them. And if you think about it, the advances in our knowledge and our understanding of the world in which we live only proves to highlight this, doesn't it? There's just so much in this world to be seen and heard and do. So what should this do? What does the preacher want this to do to us? Well, I think he wants us to be humbled. What is it about this world? What is it about us that expects that we can understand and grasp and manipulate the whole of creation for our gain? And of course, we do it in small parts, don't we? But the preacher says it's just too vast to ever be controlled and grasped and gripped and manipulated the way we seem to want to. But there's a second problem. Not only is the world not only has the world always existed, and not only is it too vast to be controlled, but we are so temporary that even the things that we do on earth are not remembered. We have no lasting legacy. Look at verse 11. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. Now, let me just illustrate this point. Anyone out there can tell me who invented the television? Anybody? Yeah, John Logie Baird, that's right. Okay, anyone tell me who invented the radio? Marconi. Jeff, you're doing well. Now, here's one for you. Who invented the wheel? Now, if we look back at history, we can tell you when wheels started to appear and started to be used. But no one has a clue. No one has a clue who invented it specifically. Why? Well, it's been forgotten. Perhaps no one chose to record it in the first place. What we do on this earth, the preacher says, will not be remembered. There is no real legacy. No matter how much we like to think, there will be a legacy for what we do. And our world likes to think that way. In 100 years, never mind 1,000 years or 3,000 years or however long it's been since we've had wheels, but in 100 years, no one's going to remember who I am. No one's going to remember who Steve Moore was. Now, there's something deeply unsettling about this. It leaves a bit of a sour taste in our mouth and does for the preacher as well. What's the point of anything if we can't manipulate its vastness, if we won't be remembered for the things that we do? We can't make an impression, so why are we here? What meaning can be found amidst the vastness and sameness of our world? Now, let's think about how we can apply this just for a moment. This is what one commentator says. He says, the world is, of course, there for our use, but we must always use it in an attitude of worship and praise that offers everything back to God. Now, evangelicals, if we want to put a label on ourselves, are not often known for speaking about creation care. We usually just kind of leave that to the liberals, but I really think that this is an error. I think that God cares deeply about creation. From the beginning, we were given a rule, weren't we? What was our rule? We were given the rule of filling and subduing the world. And that word subdue does not mean exploit. But exploitation is exactly what we've done. In our sin, we've exploited the world. The effect of our sin in general on this world has been damaging, hasn't it? It's been damaged so much that we read in Romans 8 that the world itself is crying out, waiting. Creation itself is waiting, groaning for the revealing of the sons of God, groaning and waiting for the day when that work that's been begun in us will be brought to completion. Well, why are they groaning? Well, because God's care for creation extends beyond that initial rule we were given. We messed up the world, and He's going to fix it. God will, revelation, make all things new. The gospel is not just about individual restoration, nor is it about communal restoration. These things are important, aren't they? They're crucial. But there's a third aspect to the gospel. It's about cosmic restoration. Jesus came to reconcile all things, not all people, but all things to Himself. So what are we going to say in response to this? Well, I think we should be challenged that if the earth is important to God, so important that He died for us, but also for our community and for our world to be restored to the way it should be, and I think it should be important to us. Should we not seek to use it without abusing it? What can I do to ensure that this is the case? Okay, so moving on. The preacher moves from looking at the world itself to look at two things we can do specifically, as we mentioned at the start, wisdom and pleasure. Let's look at the feelings of wisdom first. Look at verse 13. The preacher says, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. He looks to knowledge and understanding of what is good and what is evil and pursues it for everything that can be done in the world. Now, I should point out by way of reminder, if you weren't here last time or if you've forgotten, that the preacher, I keep calling him the preacher, Koheleth, is the way it's written in Hebrew. Scholars think that it's probably not Solomon, but whatever the case, if it's not Solomon, what he's doing here is putting himself firmly in the shoes of Solomon To make the point that he wants to make about wisdom, he places himself in the shoes of the wisest man who has ever lived. It's quite a wise thing to do, really, isn't it? But look at the surprising thing that the preacher says about wisdom. Verse 13, he says, "It's an unhappy business that God has given the children of man to be busy with." Now, in first reading, this really is a shocking statement. It's even blasphemous, not the sort of thing that you expect to hear out of a preacher's mouth. But what's he talking about? What's he on about? Well, when I was studying this, it became clear to me that there is a link here back to Genesis 3, back to the fall. Do you remember what the fall was caused by? What fruit did they disobey God and eat off? Well, they ate of the tree of what? The knowledge of good and evil. And why did they do that? What was it that Satan said to them back in Genesis 3, verse 5? He said, "When you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Now, of course, the problem with this statement is that it's not true. And that's the problem with trying to seek understanding and in everything. To be wise is, of course, to know what is good and what is bad, and to pursue what is good, to pursue a complete knowledge of the world and do what is good. But the problem with this is that to know everything is to be like God, to be God. And of course, being God is not something which is possible. But because we desire to be God, and that's what we do in our sinfulness, that's what we do when we sin, we dethrone God as the Lord of our lives and say, "Actually, do you know what? I'm king. I'm king of my life." That's what we say when we sin. So because we desire to be God, we continue to desire to be wise, to know all things like God does. So is the preacher right to pin it on God? Is he right to say, "God, it's your fault that we pursue this"? Of course, in one sense, that's not what he's really doing, is it? He's not blaming God that it's an unhappy business. He's just saying that you've given it to us, God, and it is an unhappy business. And it's the unhappiness of this is not God's fault, it's ours, because what we do is strive after the impossible. That was never the intention of wisdom. We can't exploit wisdom because our desire to know all things like God does is to strive to be God, and therefore to strive after the wind, as he puts it. He says in verse 16, it only produces vexation and sorrow. Why? Well, because in pursuing to know all things, to discover, in the pursuit of knowing all things, the preacher discovers that, well, actually, all things aren't knowable. And his desire to be wise, his desire to be so wise he knows everything, just can't be satisfied. Now, our culture, the culture we live in, it's got this arrogance that says, "I know so much better than anyone else how to live in this world." And it says it about other cultures that we live alongside, but it says it a lot about history, doesn't it? It scoffs at the things that used to be done and says, "Well, we don't do that anymore. Of course not. And so archaic." And yet, well, no, we say that, and in a sense, you can understand why. There's been advancements in technology, hasn't there? And healthcare, and we understand much more about the human body and about science and all of these things. There has been huge advancements, but also look back at the last 100 years, and what do we see? We see some of the most horrific things that have ever happened in the history of mankind. Think about what happened in Germany during the Second World War. Think about what happened in communist Russia under Stalin. Think about what happened in places like Yugoslavia. Think about what's happening in places like Nigeria and Iraq and Iran today. The problem with wisdom is that to be wise, knowledge of what is good and what is bad is required. And with the knowledge of these things is the temptation to exploit. It's always there. The temptation to use others for our gain. But the call of the gospel is so different to this, isn't it? The call of the gospel is to serve, to humble ourselves, to lose our lives, to submit to authority, to submit to God, to pick up our cross, to follow. That's what knowing Jesus does. It completely turns the world upside down. He sacrifices his own life to save ours. So here's the challenge. Does this sort of living characterize our lives? Do we live differently from the world? Do we resist the temptation to exploit others for our own gain? And we can also be arrogant in Christianity, I think. Yes, because we know that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. But with that is this temptation to be smug and to look down our noses at other people. Consider ourselves better than them. Of course, the story in the Bible that rings in my head is that parable that Jesus tells of that Pharisee who is thanking God that he's not like the man who's beating his breast. Isn't this contrary to the gospel? Just think about that for a moment. How do you view people outside of Jesus? Do you look down at them arrogantly? Or do you say, that's who I am. That's who I am without Jesus in my life. How do we look at those people outside of Christ? And let's move on to the feelings of pleasure. So having explored pursuing wisdom, he turns his attention to pleasure in chapter 2, verse 1. He says, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Note the controlled nature of his pursuit of pleasure. He's testing it. He's allowing himself to give it a go. And his pursuit of pleasure, well, it's pretty comprehensive. Look down at verse 10. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. He tells us he pursues laughter, wine, great works, great possessions, treasures, and concubines. What's he doing? Well, he's exploring fun, achievement, possessions, and sex. Notice that he did indeed find pleasure in all of these things. Verse 10 again, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for all my toil. And yet, verse 11, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was hebel, a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. On the one hand, he finds pleasure in those things he seeks pleasure in, and yet the satisfaction he's looking for, the gain that he wants, well, it can't be found. Why? Well, pleasure, although it's pleasurable, cannot be exploited, can it? I can't make pleasure last longer than it lasts. It's just the way it is. It's not able to be controlled and manipulated. Now, if there's one thing in our world that our culture is obsessed with, it's pleasure. You need to turn on the TV. You only need to go out onto Botchergate on a Friday or a Saturday night. You need to go on Facebook to see our culture is obsessed with pleasure. It idolizes it. Now, of course, we can shake our heads. We can lament about the state of our country, about the state of our cultures. But do you know what? A few weeks ago, I was at a prayer meeting for hope, and we were just praying for each other and for the ministries that we had in this city. And during the prayer meeting, one of the other leaders in the city just broke down and wept. And he wept because those people, the people that we're talking about, those people who are seeking pleasure in things, they're lost. They're dead. They're looking for meaning in hell. I think that this guy had the right attitude. We look at people searching for satisfaction in something they can't find it in. It should break our hearts, shouldn't it? And the simple question really is, does it break our hearts when we see people like that? Are we hurt inside when we see someone looking for God in the wrong place? Should we just pause and pray about that for a minute? Father, forgive us for our apathy sometimes. Forgive us for ignoring the facts, really, about what becomes of those outside of you. Lord, would you break our hearts for our city? Think about how you wept over yours. We pray, Father, that we would have a heart like that for the people of Carlisle. It would deeply upset us to know that they don't know you, that they are walking in death. They're not alive. Pray you would stir our hearts to do that in Jesus' name. Amen. So pursuing gain in wisdom is futile, because our sinful desire to be like God and know all things is not achievable, and pursuing gain in pleasure is futile because, well, it can't be manipulated or prolonged. The preacher says, I've tried and I can't find satisfaction in either of these things. But what he does next is he presents us with the ultimate problem, the heart of the problem for both of these things. Verse 13, he says, there's more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than darkness. Pursuing gain in wisdom, although ultimately futile in terms of finding meaning, it doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. It just means that we can't find meaning in being wise. It's much better to be wise than to be foolish, the preacher says. But even so, verse 15, the problem, then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. For of the wise as of the fool, there's no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. Ultimately, there's no gain because there is a problem which transcends any gain that we would seek to find in our toil, and that's death. We try so hard to prolong life, and yet death comes to us all. No matter how much wisdom we have, death comes. It makes no difference whether you're a fool or wise. Death comes to all. We can pursue pleasure and can't make the moment last. We can throw ourselves into our world, but we can't take anything with us. We've got no answer to death. Death even ruins our legacy. If we lived in the world, at least we would have some control over what people say about us. We can't even take our possessions with us. We leave them to someone else. And we can't control what they're going to do. So what conclusion does the preacher come to? Well, he says, verse 15, "So I hated life, because what is done under the sun is..." "And I hated life because..." Verse 15, where are you? "So I hated life because what is done under the sun is..." What's that word supposed to be? I've got "previous," which is wrong. "Grievous to me." There we go. "For all is hevel and a striving after the wind." Then verse 20. "So I turned and gave my heart up to despair over all the toils of my labors under the sun." The hevel, the breath-like nature of the gain in wisdom and pleasure, extends to gain in life. Death awaits us all. If all that is to be pursued in life is gain, if the best we can do is take and exploit the temporary satisfaction that these things bring, well, it's ultimately pointless. "We may as well chase after the wind," he says. It's no wonder that he reaches this conclusion, is it? That he hates life, that he despairs at it. Now, of course, we as Christians have an answer to death, don't we? We say, "Death, where is your sting?" Why? Well, because Jesus rose from the dead, didn't he? He rose from the dead, and in his rising from the dead, he gives us hope, a glorious hope of a future with him, where we exist with him in perfection forever. That's a wonderful thing, and that's a wonderful thing that we need to live in light of. But we must not do what we can sometimes become guilty of. Sometimes I think as Christians we live as if we miss the bus to glory. We just sit back and wait. But we're not called to sit back and wait. We're called to engage with this world. And the preacher kind of gives us some indication of how we need to do that in the next bit. And that's our second point, living the gifts. Look at those last three verses. "There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat? Or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he has given the busyness of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind." Notice the shift in focus here. So where living for gain was all about the preacher, all about what he did, what he pursued, the focus changes. The central character in these verses is God, and the central point is what God gives. Look at the last bit of verse 24. "This also I saw is from the hand of God." Verse 26, God has given. The only way to live in this world, which is not right, is to enjoy the gifts that God has given you, the common graces that we have, to enjoy food and drink and work. They are gifts given to you by God to be enjoyed, not to be exploited. God wants us to enjoy ourselves. That's why these things exist in the first place. The problem with sin is it's taken every single one of them and corrupted them. Food is good, but greed is bad. Drink is good, but drunkenness is bad. Sex is good, love is good, but lust is bad. Work is good, but overwork is bad. All of these things have been given to us as gifts. That's what the preacher says. A life that lives these gifts, then, is a life that longs to please God. And it's ironic, actually, that in these things that we pursue for meaning with gain, these are the things that the person who lives the gifts gets, isn't it? Look at that. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. The one who pleases God is the only one who truly gains anything. The preacher argues that this is true, but strangely he concludes by saying, well, what does he mean? He concludes by saying, this also is vanity and a striving after the wind. What does he mean here? It seems to me that although he holds these things to be true, that life is a gift, that these things are to be enjoyed, and that ultimately the righteous, the pleasers of God, will prosper, it's just that he looks around himself at the world and he says, well, how can these things be? That's just not what I see at all. Rarely does the world seem to match up with this. How is it that the pleasers of God can find any gain at all? Well, of course, we are very fortunate, aren't we? Because we live after Jesus. And he's the answer to that question. It's in him who makes, these things possible. It's Jesus. It's in Jesus that the good will live and evil will perish. It's in him that ultimate satisfaction that we are longing for is found. He's that spring of water, isn't he? That will satisfy our thirst forever. Striving to be good, to please God in our own strength, is a chasing after the wind as well. It can't be done, but in Jesus, the satisfaction we long for is found. And it's found not by trying really hard. It's found by going to God and saying, I am not good enough. Forgive me. Submitting to his Spirit. That's where it's found. What does he say? Well, he says, forever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Jesus is the paradox that makes sense of this complex world in which we live. He humbles himself to be exalted. He serves to conquer. He dies to bring life, and he's wounded to heal. Jesus is the answer to this question. It's in him that we can truly live and enjoy life as it's intended to be. And just on that point, on those points of food and drink and all those things that the preacher says, see, this is something that Jesus does. There's this old joke about Luke's gospel. Do you know the joke about Luke's gospel that says that Jesus is either on his way to Ada or on his way home from a feast? If you read through it, it's actually kind of true. He's often eating, isn't he, and enjoying food with other people. So I think he kind of takes the preacher's advice on that one and shows us that it's a good way to live. Well, let's just finish then by looking at some questions together. So the questions are, firstly, do I use or abuse creation? Do I use what I know to exploit other people? Does my heart break for the lost in this city? Have I naturalized death? Now, by that, what I mean is that in the passage, the preacher says that death is this ultimate problem, and yet our society says, well, you know, everybody dies. That's just what happens. Make the most of your life. Do whatever you want. Try and be happy. That's all that matters in the end. And the preacher's just not satisfied with that answer. He says, well, no, death is not natural. It's not the way things are supposed to be. So the question to ask ourselves is, have we naturalized it when actually we should denaturalize it and say, look, it's not right. And of course it's not right because, well, one day we're going to be raised with God. So have I naturalized death? And finally, do I enjoy the good things of life? Do I look at the sunset and admire its beauty? Do I have a delicious meal and say, well, that was fantastic. Thank you, Lord. Do I do these things? There's some questions to consider. Let's look at them for just a couple of minutes, and then I'll ask Richard and the band to come up again, and then I'll close in prayer, and our service will be over.